the impression to me, what I would compare it to is, you know, on the ground, Waymo looks like ChatGPT and Tesla looks like Grok, is what it is.
Hello and welcome to the Etonicast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
Fire. I am Alex Roy, the co-founder and general partner of New Industry Venture Capital and co-host of the Tool or Die podcast and host of The Best Party in Detroit, the week of Reindustrialized. You can check it out at alexroyparty.com.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors and the programming director for the Ride AI Summit.
And intrepid traveler and robo-taxi observer.
Yeah.
I want to hear the secrets. I want to hear what you discovered in Austin. Can you do that?
We got to set this up. So you've been in Austin.
I've been in Austin.
You've been tracking the Tesla robo-taxis. And I'm assuming, to be fair, also the Waymos. And I'm wondering if Alex gave you any tips on his previous role as special projects.
Yeah. Well, you know, Alex and I operate under a very strict friendie, but of course, you know, I do happen to know that he has a bit of expertise when it comes to, shall we say, competitive research in the autonomous vehicle space. And so I of course, reached out. I wouldn't take on something like this without consulting with him. And of course, that was extremely helpful. It's funny. It's been 10 years since the battery swap stakeout. This is the first sort of on the ground sort of investigation of Tesla that I've done. And I forgot how much fun it is. Like, get out from behind the computer, go see some stuff. And I will say as well, stakeouts are a lot more fun when they're easy. I went there expecting to take, you know, a day to find their depot. And it took me an hour to find the depot, about an hour and a half maybe. And then I was expecting, you know, once they started the service on Sunday, I thought it would be potentially, you know, days before I certainly budgeted days to like follow vehicles around and see, you know, wait until I saw something that was like sort of obviously problematic. Because, you know, when you get to a driverless, when you're driver out, right, by that point, things should be pretty well handled, right? It took me less than an hour. It took me less than half an hour. By 6:30 a.m. on Sunday, with the day that they opened the service, the second vehicle that I followed, I found it coming basically to a stop in the left lane of a 40-mile-per-hour road because there were police officers in a nearby parking lot, as far as I could tell. I posted that video, and apparently NHTSA's asking Tesla about it, and it's on the city of Austin's sort of dashboard of events of concern. So, you know,
can you tell us about that event?
Yeah. So, you know, the depot, and it's really, it's maybe generous to call it a depot. It's a parking lot. It's a parking lot with a chain link fence and like privacy barrier, a place called Altdorf Road in South Austin. And, essentially, you know, there's sort of two places where vehicles kind of come in and out, but mostly it's on Altdorf Road. They sort of take a left on this like fairly high speed road and head towards the South Austin geofence. And you know, got behind a vehicle, had a little GoPro and a magnet mount. And first of all, they come out of that like pretty fast. It's a 40-mile-per-hour road. It's pretty much the fastest road, as far as I can tell, in the high speed limit in the geofence. And they are not shy about, it's funny, I was in a rental Mitsubishi Mirage and I was having to step on it to keep up with these driverless robo-taxis. And you know, they're pretty regularly, you know, at or even slightly over the speed limit, which was interesting in and of itself. But the first one that I followed, I didn't accelerate fast enough. It was going way faster than I thought, and I lost it. And so the second one that I followed, I'm behind it, you know, sort of catch up to the light. We're next to each other at a light. And earlier I noticed this situation. It's funny because it didn't even occur to me that it would be something that the vehicles would respond to weirdly, because basically there's a strip mall on the north side of Altdorf, and large chunks of this strip mall and the parking lot were sort of blocked off by police vehicles. There was, you know, crime scene tape around it. And clearly there'd been some sort of crime overnight. And when I'd first sort of was driving out to the depot, I saw there were police officers out and about sort of investigating. But an hour later, when I followed this vehicle past, I didn't see like any pedestrian, you know, any cops around it. But there was like five or six police vehicles. One of them was blocking the entrance to the parking lot, but the other ones were like in the parking lot. And what was interesting about it is that it didn't respond to all of the vehicles. Like it clearly, like it sort of passed the first one, and then it was pretty far away from me when it first started. It braked for the, I think it was the second or the third police vehicle in a row. And it was sort of surprising, and I sort of caught way up to the vehicle. I was like, oh, that's weird. And then it passed another one. It got back up to speed. It passed another police vehicle. And again, these were, you know, off the road. They were not in drivable space. They were not moving. The lights were rotating, but they were completely static. And then the last of these police officers was, you know, there was a grass median between the parking lot that it was in and the car I was following. And the car that I was following came to it may have even been a full stop. I actually lost it because the GoPro could only catch a certain angle, and I was luckily in the other lane. But I, you know, went past this robotaxi. Responding to police vehicles inconsistently, responding to them by stopping in the middle of the road in the left lane on a 40-mile-per-hour speed limit road. You know, this was not good stuff. And like I said, this was the first sort of like actual vehicle that I followed out of the depot. So, you know, didn't expect to see something that bad that fast. It wasn't, you know, an unusual situation, but, you know, Austin, South Austin is full of construction that pops up here and there, and obviously police investigations and things like that. So this is like pretty normal, and it's otherwise a very easy geofence.
So your video wasn't the only video, obviously. And it's been interesting because the first week, kind of as expected, all the influencers, like the big time Tesla loyalists, descended on Austin, not necessarily being from there. It seems like they've since all left. So there was a flurry of activity, lots of video. Senior reporter at TechCrunch, Sean O'Kane, whom we all know well, had a great line for it. And he was equating the reaction to these videos or the reaction to the robotaxis in general as like a Rorschach test, because you could see a video in which it's clearly breaking the law, going in the wrong lane. There's one video in particular where it crosses the yellow lane and it goes into like a turning lane, and then it's like briefly an oncoming traffic. And the reaction, depending on the person's belief system, it's either like an example of how Tesla is 100% going to crush Waymo in any other competition, or probably something more about what Ed probably would come to the conclusion of, which is this is incredibly dangerous and an example of misuse and a lack of technology. So it was really fascinating to see actually the reactions to the videos and how people would rationalize themselves into thinking that, you know, Tesla is in any way, like not even like, oh, good job, Tesla, but like, this is a clear example of how they will dominate the world. Like it wasn't, there was no medium reaction to this.
Well, that's why these people were invited, right? Was because that's what their reaction was. My favorite example of this was the woman who was in the back seat of one of these robotaxis, apparently without her seatbelt on. And it did some kind of like intense phantom braking, again, you know, sort of like what I'd seen. Although it wasn't clear from her angle what it was responding to. It may have been something that was reasonable to respond to. We don't really know. But she was certainly taken by surprise. But she had that like this moment where she was clearly like, you could hear the terror in her voice, and then she immediately recovers. And she's like, you know, this is totally normal. FSD just does this. Like this is, you know, and it was pretty amazing to see that live of like her, like tamp down the terror in her voice and like return to that like even tone and like immediately get back on message.
So Alex, you used to work at Argo AI several years ago. So you understand to a certain degree, they never commercially launched, but they definitely were testing and things like that. And you saw a lot of operations. So what's your take on what you know so far of not just what you've seen, but your understanding how a lot of these things work in the industry?
You know, Argo was, you don't want to be out there deployed until the product is baked, like the UX is fully baked, and it's, you know, and that means you want to not just move beyond like safety issues, but comfort issues, like ride comfort issues. Tesla was under a deadline, a self-imposed deadline to do something. And you know, let's call it minimum viable autonomy theater. And so one of the things which was compressed is the timeline for resolving, you know, ride comfort and, you know, and UX. And, but they're, you know, they had to make this deadline, and then they tried to mitigate whatever the, you know, UX deficiencies are by selecting Tesla favorable influencers. And this is textbook Tesla. And, you know, the folks they selected are clearly heavily biased towards the most favorable interpretation of any event. And you can see the psychology of these people, because a couple of influencers, one of them's Miss Julianne on Twitter. Have you guys seen her account? But she's a Tesla, you know, fan, and there's a lot of content about them, and she was not invited. And so her point of view on Tesla inverted completely in the last 2 weeks. She's now super hostile to Tesla and calling out every single thing that is not perfect. And so when I was at Argo, one of the things I got to do a lot was ride in our own vehicles. And, you know, there was the official operations performance assessment team that would look at what, you know, our ops people were telling them, you know, about vehicle behavior. And then there was me and the occasional other executive who would come down and get a ride themselves. And so we would deliver like much harsher criticism than ops would internally, because Brian asked for it. Brian's like, pull no punches. Tell me directly what you feel. And I did that, but we were very specifically not going public at that time. And so we never got to the phase of having influencers and third parties in the car. And Brian, I'm pretty sure, would not have allowed it until the ride comfort was solved. Tesla clearly has not solved it. And there are other issues too.
Well, I'm wondering if you have seen the video in which, I think this is, I hate to give him any platform, but
you don't have to. You can just say it's a Tesla influencer.
A Tesla influencer that shows a dual video of a Waymo and a robo-taxi going to the same destination, and one being longer than the Tesla being shorter and faster in a quote-unquote better pickup. The hard thing I have with these videos is that we're supposed to trust the quality of these videos in spite of knowing these people's clear bias. And I would, by the way, say the same thing. And if you were a stranger to me, I'd be like, well, he's clearly biased against Tesla. Can I, you know, trust the video? And all you can do is like, it be based on like a consistent record of truth, right? So based on that, I'm not so sure I can trust them.
Yeah. Well, let me say something about the route question, because, you know, people, you know, when I was at Argo, we had the same thing. Our vehicle would take routes that were longer than an Uber or even a human driver. And there was a reason for that, is that we were, you know, getting data from third parties, including Nexar, about like different, you know, the safety of specific roads and intersections. And our routing would consider a number of factors, traffic, and then of course risk. If some intersections are riskier than others, you're better off not going through them. And so, you know, I don't know what goes into Waymo's calculus here, but I'm quite sure that Tesla does not consider probably any of that stuff, and they're just taking shortest route. And shortest route over time, if you always take the shortest route, you increase the likelihood of passing through an intersection that's high risk. And then at that point, over time, as you scale, you are going to have an incident sooner. So that's my take.
And here's what you don't, there's actually a number of things that you don't see in the video. So I think it's, what's interesting is right, Tesla very clearly selected like who they wanted to give access to for this, you know, rollout. It was all very, you know, people with proven track record of favorability. And yet every day there was at least one video that showed like a pretty significant, whether it was a safety issue or a significant safety, a comfort issue, so, you know, that speaks for itself. But, you know, as usual, there's, I think, too much focus on these videos. And what you don't see in the videos is the context. And I think it's super important. And having spent like over a week there, it's important to understand this is a very small geofence, very small. And it is a very simple geofence, too. You know, I remember getting a ride from Argo, and all of us got a ride from Argo in Pittsburgh in, was that 2018 or whatever? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a much, much more challenging geofence in a lot of ways than almost anything that you see in South Austin. It's very low speed. It's very sedate. People don't drive very fast. There's not a lot of, you know, there's like Lamar, South Lamar is like a bit of a busy road and there's some kind of challenges there. The intersection of Lamar and like Barton Spring, there are places that are sort of busy and complex and you get some, but there's almost no pedestrians, even though it's like the most walkable part of Austin. You know, I would go for a walk every night. I'd go like three blocks being in Oregonia and like start sweating and be like, oh yeah, this is why nobody walks here. But it's super easy. And the other thing, I think beyond the safety stuff, right? The safety stuff speaks for itself. Like you should not be seeing a safety issue every day when you're driverless and only giving access to friendlies. Like you should not be seeing as many safeties as you did. But what people don't see is that in this very small, very easy geofence, it's absolutely blanketed with non-robotaxi Teslas on manufacturer plates. And this is, I think, kind of the you know, people are a little bit missing the forest for the trees here, because I think this to me is the real issue, right? There's two parts. One is that it's blanketed with Teslas. The other is that is the context of Waymo. And we'll get to the Waymo piece in a sec. But with Tesla, like for every one robotaxi that you see in this geofence, there are at least 10 other Teslas that are almost all launch edition Model Ys, which is interesting in of itself. The new Juniper Model Ys launch edition with the badge and everything on manufacturer plates. And those are, it's interesting. I really tried to pay attention to those. It's a mix. Some of them are doing validation work. So you can tell that it's, you know, in using FSD of some kind and, you know, being supervised with someone behind the wheel. Some of them are definitely being human driven. And what's interesting is that even the human driven ones are doing simulated pickups and drop offs. A lot of what they're doing is simulated pickups. Some of them just seem to be driving around. Some of them are doing clearly simulated pickups and drop offs, which by the way, the robotaxis were too. Even during when people, those first days of the launch, when people were doing these videos, you'd still follow the robotaxis and they would just go out to a neighborhood, do a fake pickup, go to another place, do a fake drop off, and then go back, you know. Anyway, the point is that you know, Tesla is not like Waymo in the sense that Waymo has always been developing a robotaxi service, and they've been doing that in a consistent, principled way, market by market. Tesla is doing this to, right, as Alex said, it's theater to promote, you know, confidence in their general solution. Well, I'll tell you what, like if you're on the ground and you're there and you're seeing all of the testing and data gathering that they're doing just for this one small geofence, like this is not a generalizable thing. Like what the work that they're doing in order to do driver out is not scalable, like in my view. Unless the testing they're doing is totally unrelated, which I have a hard time believing, because otherwise, why is this one geofence?
So, quick question: when they're human driven, are they simply just collecting data on like the pickup and drop off and then funneling that back into their training models? Are they mapping? Like what's
so I don't think it's mapping. Okay. There's been pictures of specific mapping rigs. So there's pictures of LiDAR rigs, which we'll talk about in a second. There's other ones that have like a central that look more they have a central rotating LiDAR that people seem to think are the mapping ones. So I don't think they're mapping, but I think it's doing a combination of validation, right? Human supervised sort of validation. But then also, you know, my understanding is Tesla is very big on behavior cloning as a sort of development technique. And so I think, right, so you know, the narrative has always been Tesla has this huge fleet and they get all this data from it, and that's what's their advantage. Well, they do have a big fleet, but it's owned by them and it's driven by their employees in the geofence that they're trying to validate, right? And validate and develop data for. And what they don't have is, I think, a lot of data about pickups and drop-offs, which, as Alex and everybody else in the robotaxi business knows, is really hard. And we know that Tesla's hiring for people to work on this problem specifically. So my sense is that a certain amount of these vehicles are human-driven and doing simulated pickups and drop-offs in order to generate data that they think represents good examples that they can use to train the system. Mm-hmm. I think that is a significant amount of what we're seeing out there. Alex?
Quick question. Did you observe any Teslas that are operating as lead or follow vehicles to bracket the robotaxis?
So generally speaking, the robotaxis were actually going out alone, and certainly when the service started, and certainly everyone that was taking a ride was clearly like they kept any kind of chase or lead vehicle away, and I think it was for optics pretty clearly. That said, you do absolutely see the development vehicles going out in groups. One time I saw one, it really interesting, it was a human driven in front. You could tell, you know, it was low speed in a neighborhood. I was, again, a pedestrian, so I was able to really kind of see as they all came into a stop. First one was human driven, middle one was hands off the wheel, and the back one was hands on. So, you know, you see a real mix of stuff in the development vehicles, but the robotaxis themselves, again, I think, you know, they're putting influencers in those things. I think if they have the chase or the lead car, you know, sort of the illusion that they're trying to create, you know, gets broken. And so the robotaxis themselves were very much, for the most part, especially if they're picking up a human, were completely by themselves.
To me, what's so interesting about this is that if you were to change the take the influence, if Tesla had done this instead, if they had not done the influencer thing, if they had simply focused on simulations, mapping, collecting data in Austin, and then let's say 6 months from now started rolling out and inviting influencers, I think that there would be a very different result. And it feels like they're very much like constantly in catch-up mode and cramming mode. And the thing is that you can't cram for this kind of test.
That's right.
Yeah. You can, and you can get some okay results, right? Like we see that they're operating, but the result of getting everything right, or the chances of getting everything right, are like very slim as a result.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, so I was going to say, so you mentioned catch-up mode, and that's the other major impression from spending a week on the ground in South Austin, right? Which is that, you know, you've got a number of things going with Tesla. You've got the robotaxis going out. That's very small fleet. You've got also a very small fleet of validation Teslas that have LiDAR on their roof racks, which we've seen in California, but there's actually quite a few of those relative to what we've seen in California that just seem to be around Austin. Those, I think, seem to be used to grow the geofence. You don't see them inside the operating geofence. I think that's what they're using to validate outside the existing geofence in order to expand it. And then you have this massive development fleet of the unmanufactured plates. So all in all, there's like a ton of Teslas in this one geofence. And the contrast that gets, so, and I think for a lot of people, they see the ones that don't have the robotaxi, but the development vehicles, which is the largest part of that fleet, and they don't notice a manufacturer plate. To them, it's just another Model Y driving around. But when you start to notice it, that's massive. The contrast, though, is with Waymo, because right, Waymo's geofence is now at least double Tesla's. So they cover the exact Tesla, and then they get downtown, and then up to University of Austin, and a couple of the northern suburbs, and it's considerably larger.
If you look at the Waymo publishes their geofence, and it is, I can look up the square mileage, but yeah, it's about 2/3 larger.
But so you see Waymos constantly, like all over, certainly around the geofence, but also again, beyond it. They're all driverless. They're all very confident and naturalistic. The impression overall that you get being there is 100% Tesla is trying to catch up. They're really focused on a fraction of Waymo's geofence to get up to their standard there. The impression to me, what I would compare it to is, you know, on the ground, Waymo looks like ChatGPT and Tesla looks like Grok is what it is, right? ChatGPT is the 60% market share, and it shows when you compare it to Grok. And that comparison, I think, holds up here.
Here's my question. There's, you know, every couple of years, Tesla or Elon changes his focal love from one Tesla influencer to another. So at one point we had Fred Lambert. We don't have to discuss at all because he's unserious. And then there was Sawyer Merritt. He's still around. And then recently, and Holmar's catalog, obviously. Well, last week, Elon unfollowed him for a few days. And now there's this guy, Nick Cruz Patan. I don't know how to pronounce his name. So he's out there like, and he's like, yeah, every single Tesla on the road is the same as, you know, the Model Y robotaxis. But I recall seeing several pictures suggesting that the Model Y robotaxis in the Tesla fleet have an additional piece of hardware in the rearview mirror mounted to the glass, as well as a metal plate at the rear end of the vehicle down near the bottom. Have you seen those pictures? What is that? And what is about that hardware in the window?
Yeah. So I will say it is kind of hard to see when they're out driving around. Like the robotaxis aren't ever just sort of stopped. So you really can only sort of see them when they're driving around. And so when your eyes behind the wheel, I've seen some of that. But I will say it's relatively hard to kind of see I know there was some talk about, like, for example, like camera cleaners and stuff, certainly from behind. I didn't see real evidence of like camera cleaning hardware that was obviously new on those vehicles. So I will say, I mean, like it was hard to tell the difference. However, right, there were clear differences. You can absolutely tell very easily, especially after a few days of observation, what the robotaxis are. One of the big one is the robotaxis have standard non-manufacturer Tesla plates, because it is illegal to give paid rides on manufacturer plate vehicle in the state of Texas. And so that is the easiest way to distinguish between this giant like development fleet that they have operating there and the actual robotaxis, because the development fleet is all manufacturer plates, and the robotaxis have standard. And then of course, you know, if you can see the driver's seat, right, there's no one in there.
But did you, at any point, have you seen those pictures online of that extra piece of hardware in the rear window?
I very briefly, I've not made intensive study of it.
Because I mean, I can't, I'm wondering if that is some additional, because why would it be in the rear window? Right. Because it involves communication, transmission and receipt of data.
Well, and we know they have teleop.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that additional module is necessary. That is important because it suggests that not only is, you know, hardware 3 versus 4 a differentiator in what a Tesla could be capable of, its potential for driverless operation, but if that additional unit is necessary for remote operations, then any unit that does not have that, any Tesla doesn't have that, and that's 100% of cars being sold and delivered today to normal people like myself, then they're not going to be robotaxis, be driverless capable, unless something else happens, an evolution of something else in the system. And I don't believe that any AV will be deployed ever without, I'm going to call it customer service. And customer service requires communications and a control input in the event of an emergency.
Well, yeah. Is that customer service or is that safety related? Because safety should be baked in and, you know, it's not
like... You shouldn't be relying on that for safety. Yeah.
Safety is table stakes. But fundamentally, I mean, all operations are, or operations pertaining to the vehicles are, customer service function. The industry should have branded it that years ago and been transparent at that time. And because they weren't, now they're caught up in this soup and debate over what degree of teleoperation is sufficient or good or competent or safe. Kirsten.
Yes. Well, so we've been having for years conversations about words, why they matter. And a lot of times it's been around how ADAS is branded, but also I will extend this now to the whole topic of remote driving / teleoperations. And, you know, there's been some interesting coverage about it. A friend of the pod, I should say, Yanko on her Substack has a story that's very interesting, and it really digs into, based on an on-record source, I should say. So I think it's notable that this person's on record about Waymo's operations. And there's some big question marks that I have around their operations and how vetted these people are. But my big concern is that Waymo or Zooks or people covering it or former crews or Tesla all use different language, so that we don't know if this is a and actually we should have the founder of Vay on, because he does the driverless car sharing stuff, and he kind of broke it down for me. Like, there's the one-to-one driving, so that's when you see like the steering and all that stuff, and then there's like the, you know, suggested, the software commands suggested, but people are using the same language to describe this totally different functionality.
Well, we should also have, let's invite Elon Podhurst, because he did the taxonomy of levels of teleoperation. And that's really important, because I haven't seen anyone else try to define it. And these definitions matter.
Yeah. Well, so one of the questions I had when I went to Austin was sort of what could I find out about the role of teleops? And I will say it was hard, right? So one of the scenarios that I envisioned was that there might be evidence that most or all or some large part of what they were doing was teleoperated. I mean, the fact that the first vehicle I saw
You say teleoperated, you mean steering wheel?
Yeah. Like actually,
person in room,
actually full remote operation. The fact that, you know, we saw pretty clearly, you know, from day one, from hour one, you know, errors that only an automated system would make, right? Like so clearly, it's not that this was all just completely faked. So that was the interesting piece of seeing a safety issue. That said, you know, you do see points where the Teslas, you know, seem to be taking longer at a stop sign or in other situations than they would normally, or that seem normal. But the recovery was pretty good. It wasn't like Cruise. Kirsten, you remember cycling through San Francisco and just seeing Cruises just like stopped because you know, there'd be someone getting into a parked car, or like the parked car would turn its lights on and the Cruise would just like freeze and would be there for like a while. And then eventually the driver would just take over and go.
Yeah. And the most fun one was when you would see the Cruises creeping up a very steep hill in San Francisco because the system probably believed it was about to drive off of a cliff.
Oh, right.
And you'd see it inching slowly up.
So you don't see the Teslas just frozen so much. You did, there was one drop off where it kind of was stuck in the middle of the intersection for a minute and stuff. But generally speaking, when you see hesitations are pretty brief, which suggests to me either it's possible that they program in. So I definitely think there was some hard coding going on. For example, right, there's speed bumps. There's a number around the geofence. There's definitely some speed bumps that are very intense and others that don't exist but have the same markings as the speed bumps. And the cars always know the exact difference, which is very hard to tell with just a camera. And so I'm like, and the braking is very, where the speed bumps are very aggressive, the braking is very aggressive. So either their training is bulletproof, but more likely I think they've actually hard-coded some of that stuff in. So that may be some of the behavior that we're seeing. They may have tagged certain intersections because there are certain areas where it seemed like there was more sort of hesitation. But if I saw situations where teleop was kicking in, it was pretty prompt, which means that there was definitely like a one-to-one. Yeah. And there wasn't a lot of like, let's sit around and see if the system is going to, you know, sort of collect itself and figure this out and move on. It was very clearly like, if there was any kind of meaningful hesitation for even like about a second beyond what might otherwise be normal, like something kicked in and they would just go.
Did you see the story about the a video went up, I think, about a couple that they were in a Y Robotaxi. It began raining and the vehicle stopped and it got out.
Yes. Yeah, that was one of my favorite videos. There were a couple of good ones. That was a doozy.
And there was also another video by a Tesla influencer who was in heavy rain and the thing just kept going.
Yeah.
And that suggests to me that, I mean, look, my drive in January on 13 FSC 1328, the hard ODD boundary was medium rain. And I just, you know, I drove cross country last week in my Tesla and we hit medium rain again and we had two involuntary disengagements. So it seems to me that there are two things happening here. The FSD stack that they're deploying, I don't think it's the same stack that is in my car with 1329.
It's not.
And plus one-to-one coverage, which allows you to, because when you have an involuntary disengagement due to rain in my Tesla, you get the warning, but it's the automation is still engaged for, I don't know how long it is. It's 5 seconds, 8 seconds. So you have, I wouldn't say it's a good amount of time, but you have time. And you had a one-to-one scenario with ops trained for this, and the system kicks out an involuntary disengagement, if the person's only job is to watch and take over, that would make it possible to do so with an invisible takeover to the passenger, which is not the case for other disengagements I've encountered. In the rain, my rain disengagements have always given me a few seconds. Not enough to be safe, but enough to get me to force me to do it.
So you bring up a really good point, actually. Sorry, Kirsten, I just want to make this point here because so you know, after, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 days or whatever, you know, you're observing, you learn to recognize all the different vehicles that are out there and what they are. I was walking home from dinner and sort of later in the trip and you know, it's in this, you know, quiet neighborhood, low speeds, but there's these little mini roundabouts instead of four-way stops at a couple points. And, you know, I've been seeing them take these really well, and the development vehicles and the robotaxis all handle them really, really cleanly. And I see a new Model Y coming down the road and it doesn't have a front license plate. And I immediately think this is one of the development fleet, right? Because they all have no front license plate and they have the manufacturer plate in the back. But the first thing I noticed about it as it approached this roundabout was it just was awkward. Like it just didn't drive like the other Model Ys that you see out, the development fleet and stuff that's out testing and validating or providing behavior cloning data. It just was unnatural as it approached this little mini roundabout. And this is not a complicated maneuver. It's not like a big roundabout. It's like a chicane, basically. And I was like, well, that's weird. And as it drove past, I saw, okay, definitely wasn't human driven, right? It was there was someone behind the wheel, but it was supervised. And then as it drove past, it had a private plate. So this was privately owned. So that means this was someone who was running a public build of FSD, and it looked like shit out there. It looked like it didn't know what it was doing. So 100%, and again, I don't have a lot of other data. In fact, Alex, I would recommend it would be really interesting to go to Austin, take the latest build of FSD, and see how it does in that geofence. Compare it to those development vehicles that are out there and the robotaxis that are out there. They are 100% running a custom stack. No question about it. It is trained with a huge amount of data. And again, this is the point that I want to make. Like the safety stuff is what it is. I think we all expected it. It's not really a big surprise. As long as they keep that fleet small and it's super as supervised as it is, I think they can keep the lid on that safety stuff. The real lie that's going on here is that this is proof of general capability, which is always sort of the issue with Tesla. And I will tell you, like, people should go and operate the latest FSD in this geofence. It will be obviously worse than all of those development vehicles that you see running around. And I think, you know, again, the evidence to me is pretty overwhelmingly clear that this is the vehicles that are operating that geofence are operating a unique stack that not only is trained on a lot of data specific to that geofence, but even I'm pretty sure is hard coding specific parts of that geofence that might otherwise be challenging to it.
Okay, so the question is, where does this go from here? Because if you expand beyond South Austin, it's hard to keep a lid on things.
Yes.
And I would say this for any company, Waymo included, as they expand, if they're using remote drivers, in Waymo's case, according to that one article, they're using a third-party contractor, which isn't new information. They've been known to do this in the past. But every time you scale and expand, you're opening the door for more risk. And if you don't have protections around there. So with Tesla, do they just stay in South Austin, maybe expand into East Austin a little bit and call it a day and they don't go anywhere else? Or do they try to replicate this in other areas? Because once they start expanding, things get a lot more complicated.
That's right. I spoke to someone who is in sort of regular contact with the team there, the Tesla team. And the thing that jumped out to me was that they are anxious to be done so that they can go home to California. And I'm like, what is done here?
Who's anxious to be done? You mean the
team that is putting on this robotaxi service in Austin, it is a lot of people from California. It's a lot of people who've been working, as is usual with Tesla, right? It's been an intensive thing. And by the way, I mean, you know, I don't want to overblow this sourcing. It's not a member of the team who is speaking to me, obviously, but it's just someone who speaks with them and has had an ongoing conversations with them. And again, like that's the scary thing. I think you're absolutely right. The scary thing for me is. What happens, right? Clearly, they're under pressure, as Alex said. That pressure comes from Elon. You know, at some point, Elon's going to say, like, we've created the spectacle that we set out to create. And the question is, right, it doesn't look like, the depot does not look like it's set up for permanent operations. They don't seem like they're there to set up a permanent robotaxi operation that they operate. And so that means, right, either they're going to scale for the sake of scaling and just sort of shut down in Texas. They're going to turn it over to the public, like they've talked, right? Like the whole game plan supposedly is that they just sort of say, we're done and it's safe enough. And now anybody can operate on that. And I don't know how they handle software versioning on that. Does that mean people in Austin get the stack that's tuned for Austin? You know, so I think that's really where the huge question is. And a lot of this kind of comes down to the other big stunt that was, well, that did happen, which is the driverless delivery.
That's a funny one. So someone pointed out that the Twitter account that announced he'd gotten his delivery had just been set up.
Yeah.
And that it had manufacturer plates. Is that right?
I didn't see that.
I didn't see that either.
So I staked out the Gigafactory hoping to catch this delivery.
Uh-huh.
And yeah.
And then someone said, maybe it was that his software was derated back to 13.2.9 or because they didn't use the public stack. I mean,
right. It was changed upon delivery.
I mean, let's be serious here. If that was a, game time ready product, the autonomous delivery, then every Tesla in every customer delivery in the ODD should be autonomous every day moving forward.
So let me say this.
Clearly, it's not a prime time ready functionality.
Sure. Yeah. But I would also say this. There's a long history, and Tesla is not the only offender here, of creating, what are we calling it? Minimal viable autonomy theater, or MVAT?
Yes. And yes. It feels good to use my name with the MVAT.
Or MVAT. We'll have to play around with that language. But there's a long history of that. And we can point to even established companies like Waymo doing things with prototypes to showcase. And, even early days when the Firefly was in Austin and made the big first driverless ride. I'm not saying that they're the same. I'm just saying that there's a long history of companies wanting to show capability and creating kind of a theatrical demo.
Well, everyone's done some theater. That's basic communications. The real question is are you compromising safety to execute that theater or not? Because, or are you exaggerating capability in what people should infer from that theater? Two questions.
I will also say not a lot of people are doing obvious demos in 2025. Like, 5 years ago, sure. 7 years ago, definitely. But
yeah, this is very much 2015
this is old school
vibes. But okay. So I'm gonna pull an Alex and say we're out of time, but I just wanna say one thing, which is we are back in 2015. And this is my latest example because
Tesla never left 2015.
Because Travis Kalanick is back trying to buy an autonomous vehicle company.
You think that, you're referring to the story about Uber partnering with him and they're going to buy Pony AI and he's going to run it?
The US arm, yes. Yes.
Wait, tell us your thoughts on that story, Alex. What are you hearing about this deal?
Yeah. What are you hearing about this deal?
I just told you. I've heard a lot of, Literally, no one says, I haven't heard anyone say, what a great idea.
Oh, thank goodness Travis Kalanick is getting back into our safety critical sector.
Mostly it's just, The other thing that people are giving a lot of to is the, OpenAI claiming they're going to enter.
I'm telling you guys. Yes, okay. We are back in 2015, okay. You guys.
But
we
I can say
full,
this.
Have gone full circle.
I don't know if he would want me to name him, but I asked a trusted person, one of the smartest people on earth investing in this area. I said, has anyone been able to tell you how that might work and why it's a good idea? And he's like, and this person would know. He's like, But another person said to me, a trusted person said, Sam Altman and Elon are, fighting over a dozen issues. What better way to trade a little bit of OpenAI's, narrative command, by stick it to Elon and just saying, we'll enter self-driving and we've got it. We can totally do it. That must drive Elon crazy. Crazy.
But also, I love how the fact that basically the general public ends up being the guinea pigs in this tussle between frenemies, no one wins in this scenario.
Yeah. I think, again, when you're on the street level in Austin, it's one thing on the internet, right? Because, if you've got narrative command, you can really create this perception that, you're winning or whatever. And I think what's amazing, when I was at Pave and throughout the years, there's always been this sort of sense that the bullshit will wash out the more real it gets, right? The more real things happen in the real world, the more the bullshit kind of falls aside. And I will say, you still see a lot of people who believe a lot of bullshit in Austin. There was actually a really interesting billboard there that was by the Yeti company. There's a Yeti flagship store right on South Congress, right where you cross the river and you can see downtown and the Capitol building on the other side of the river. And there's this huge billboard and it just says driverless vehicle. And it depicts a Bronco at a rodeo that has just bucked its driver off, that is falling headfirst off of this Bronco. And it's a fascinating billboard because, you know, this is one of the sort of strains of reaction that's happening on the ground there that is like, the danger is sort of part of the spectacle. I think, you know, Yeti, apparently their culture is sort of pro Elon and sort of, you know, that. So I won't say the bullshit is all washed aside, but, you know, the sort of counterexample to that I thought was really interesting was I went to one of the Tesla protests in Austin and
I could never have predicted that.
I know.
But why are you still protesting?
It's because it's what I do on Saturdays. And there was a woman there with a sign that was sort of the other pole, I think, of the sort of reaction on the ground in Austin from that billboard, which is the sign said, it was a handmade cardboard sign. It said, "I hate Waymos, but at least they work." Those are the sort of the two views. The one view is like, it's cool that this is all happening here because it's dangerous. And the other one is like, I don't like any of this, but I can tell by being here that the Waymos work, whereas the rest of it, I'm not so sure. And I think that is sort of the perspective that I think is going to grow over time. Because again, you know, the Waymo is doing all, they're doing the mapping, they're testing, they're expanding the zone, and they're offering real rides. They're doing it all driverlessly, all with the same fleet. Tesla, you know, is having to really brute force this, and on the ground, it's all really obvious. And again, the public can't get rides in those Teslas, and they can't anytime they use the Uber app.
Gotta go. We're out of time. Let's wrap this up. Let me just say, Ed, I told you Tesla would deploy something.
You know,
and like on that note,
they said that they would have they would win because they had the biggest fleet with the most data, and they were right about that. It's the fleet that they own.
And on that note, Kirsten, say goodbye. Wrap us up.
And on that note, thanks for the perspective and your boots on the ground reporting, Ed. And thank you to our audience for listening to another episode of the Autonicast.